from the attack. I think it was a cover for various archaeological digs Amari conducted in Afghanistan and Iraq, and a very sophisticated heist, a robbery. Josh looked at the table. Had David lost it? This sort of 9/11 conspiracy theory stuff was fodder for internet forums, not serious counterterrorism work. David seemed to recognize Josh's reluctance. Look, I know it sounds far-fetched, but hear me out. After 9/11, I spent almost a year in a hospital, and then rehab. That's a lot of time to think. A lot of things about the attacks made no sense to me. Why attack New York first? Why not hit the White House, Congress, the CIA, and the NSA simultaneously? Those four plane crashes would have crippled the country, especially our defensive capabilities. It would have thrown us into utter chaos. And why use only four planes? Surely they could have trained more pilots. They could have hijacked 30 planes that morning if they simply took planes from Reagan and national airports in D.C., from Baltimore, maybe Richmond. You've got Atlanta pretty close. Hartsfield-Jackson is the busiest airport in the world. Who knows? They could have probably crashed 100 planes that day before passengers started fighting back. And they had to have known that crashing planes was a one-time-only tactic. So they would have maximized the impact. Josh nodded, still skeptical. It's an interesting question. And there were others. Why strike on a day when you know the president is out of town, in an elementary school in Florida? Clearly the goal wasn't to remove our fighting capabilities. Sure, the Pentagon was hit and many brave men died, but the overall effect was to really, really piss the Pentagon and the armed forces off. The whole country, for that matter. After 9/11, America had an appetite for war the likes of which it had never seen before. There was one other striking effect. The stock market crashed. A historical crash. New York is the financial capital of the world. Hitting it makes sense if you want to do one thing. Crash the stock market. The attacks did two things really well. Ensured there was a war, a big one, and crashed the stock market. I never looked at it that way, Josh said. Things look a lot different when you spend almost a year in a hospital, learning to walk by day and asking why by night. I couldn't do much research on terrorists from a hospital bed, so I focused on the financial angle. I started looking at who the big winners were from the financial collapse. Who was betting against American stocks? What companies were shorting the market? Who owned put options? Who made a fortune? It was a long list. Then I started looking at who benefited from the wars, especially private security contractors and oil and gas interests. The list got shorter, and something else intrigued me. The attacks nearly guaranteed a war in Afghanistan. Maybe whatever this group wanted was there, and they needed a cover to go in and search for it. Or maybe it was in Iraq. Maybe both. I knew I needed to get out in the field to find some real answers. David took a breath and continued. By 2004, I was back on my feet. I applied to the CIA that year, but was turned down. I trained for another year, got turned down again in 2005, and trained some more. I thought about joining the Army, but I knew I would need to be part of covert ops to get real answers. Josh looked down, taking it in. Seeing David in a completely different light now. He had always thought of the station chief as this invincible super soldier, had always assumed that that was all he'd ever been. The idea of him laying broken in a hospital bed for a year, of him being turned down as a field operative twice, was slightly jarring. What? David said. It's nothing. I just assumed you were a career operative, that you were with the agency on 9/11. An amused smile crossed David's lips. No, not even close. I was a grad student, actually, at Columbia, if you can believe that. Might be why the CIA kept rejecting me. Didn't want anyone overthinking things in the field units. But apparently, the third time's the charm, they took me in 2006. Maybe they had lost enough operatives, or enough had joined the private contractors, whatever the reason. I was glad to be in country in Afghanistan. I found my answers. The short list I had, the three companies, were all subsidiaries of one company, Imari International. Their security division, Imari Security, coordinated their operations. But the funds from 9/11 went into several of their front companies. And I found something else, a plan for a new attack, codenamed Toba Protocol. David pointed at the file. That file is all I have on that attack. It's not much. Josh opened the file. This is why you joined Clock Tower? To investigate Imari and Toba Protocol? Partly. Clock Tower was the perfect platform for me. I knew back then that Imari was behind 9/11, that they had made a fortune from the attacks, and that they were actively looking for something in the mountains of eastern Afghanistan and Pakistan. But they got to me before I could figure out the big picture. They almost killed me in northern Pakistan. I was officially listed as killed in action. It was the perfect opportunity to exit. I needed a new identity and somewhere to continue my work. I had never heard of Clock Tower before I was in theater in Afghanistan, but I took refuge here. It was perfect. We all come to Clock Tower for our own reasons. It was the key to my survival at the time, and the tool I needed to finally learn the truth about Imari and Toba. I never told anyone my real motivation except the director. He took me in and helped me start Jakarta Station 4 years ago. I hadn't made much substantial progress on the Imari question until a week ago, when the source contacted me.
That's why the source picked you.
Apparently, he knows about my investigation. He knew I would have this file. It may hold the key to decrypting the code. What I know is that Imari Corporation is somehow involved in 9/11, maybe in other terrorist plots before and after, and that they're working on something much, much bigger. Toba Protocol. It's why I chose Jakarta, the closest major city to Mount Toba. I think it's a reference to where the attack will start.
A logical assumption. What do we know about Toba Protocol? Josh said.
Not a lot. Apart from a few references, there's one memo about it. It's a report about urbanization, transportation infrastructure, and the potential to reduce the total human population. Whatever Toba is, I believe that's the goal. To drastically reduce the total human population.
That limits the possibilities somewhat. A terrorist attack that could reduce the global population would have to be biological. Maybe a drastic change in the environment or inciting a new world war?
We're not talking about suicide bombers, it's something bigger.
David nodded.
Much bigger, and probably something we would never expect. Jakarta is the perfect place to start an attack. The population density is high, and there are tons of expatriates here. The start of an attack would send wealthy foreigners in Jakarta to the airport, and from there to almost every country in the world.
David motioned to the bank of computer screens behind Josh.
The computers behind you are connected to Central, to our own servers, and to the remaining cells. They have everything we know about what's going on around the world, the various terrorist groups and organizations we now know are fronts for Imari International. It's not much. Start there, get up to speed, then move on quickly to the latest local intel. If there's anything going on here in Jakarta, we have a responsibility to investigate it first. We will need to hand off what we know in case Jakarta Station falls. Think outside the box. Whatever is going on, it may not fit any normal patterns. Look for something we wouldn't suspect, like Saudi nationals taking flying lessons in Germany, then moving to the U.S. Like someone in Oklahoma buying tons of fertilizer. Someone who isn't a farmer.
What's in the rest of the folders? Josh said.
David pushed a folder across the desk. This folder contains the rest of the information on Imari that I collected before I joined Clock Tower.
It's not in the computer?
No. I never turned it over to Clock Tower either. You'll see why. The other envelope contains a letter, from me to you. You should open it when I die. It will provide you with instructions.
Josh started to say something, but David interrupted.
There's one last thing. David stood and retrieved a small case from the corner of the room. He set the case on the table. "This room and the outer chamber will give you some protection, and I hope enough time to find something and decode the message. Clock Tower HQ is the last place they'll be looking for you. Nevertheless, I doubt we have a lot of time. Send whatever you find to my mobile. The top right monitor shows a camera feed. That camera is over the door looking out into the server room, so you'll know if someone is trying to get in here. As you know, there are no cameras in the main HQ, for security reasons, so you may not have much notice." He opened the case and took out a handgun. He slid the magazine into the handle of the gun and placed it on the table in front of Josh. "You know how to use this?" Josh eyed the gun and leaned back in the chair. Yes. Well, I had basic training when I joined the agency 12 years ago, but I haven't used one since, so... No, not really. He wanted to say, if covert ops forces get in this room, what kind of chance do I really have? But he didn't. He knew David was showing him the gun to make him feel safer. Not being scared to death would clear his mind and help him do his job. But Josh felt that was only half of the chief's motivation. "If you need to use it, you pull the slide back. That chamber's around. When you're empty, you click here. The magazine slides out. You put another one in and press this button. The slide returns and chambers the first round from the new magazine. But if that door is breached, there's something you have to do before you use the gun. Wipe the computers?" "Exactly. And burn this folder as well as the letter." David pointed to a small metal waste basket and handed him a small butane torch from the gun box. "What else is in the box?" Josh thought he knew, but he asked anyway. The Jakarta station chief paused for a second, then reached into the box and took out a small capsule. "Do I swallow it?" "No. If the time comes, you bite into it. The cyanide works pretty quick, maybe 3 or 4 seconds. David handed Josh the capsule. "Keep it with you. I hope you won't need it. This is a very hard room to get into." David put the gun back in the box and returned it to the corner of the room. "Let me know as soon as you have something." He turned and walked toward the door. Josh stood and said, "What are you going to do?" "Buy us some time." Chapter 15. Interrogation Room C, West Jakarta Police Detention Center, Jakarta, Indonesia. Kate looked up as the interrogation room door opened, revealing a fat, sweaty man. He carried a folder in one hand and extended his other hand to her.
"Dr. Warner, I am Police Chief Eddie Kuznani. I've been waiting here for hours. Your men have interrogated me about useless details of my study, threatened to imprison me. I want to know what you're doing to find those kidnapped children."
"Doctor, you don't understand the situation here. We are a small department."
"Then call the National Police, or..."
"The National Police have problems of their own, Doctor, and they don't include finding retarded children."
"Don't call them retarded."
"They're not retarded?"
He flipped the file open.
"Our notes say your clinic is testing a new drug for retarded..."
"They're not retarded. Their brains work differently than other people's, just like my metabolism works differently than yours."
The corpulent chief looked down at his body as if trying to find his metabolism to examine and compare it with Kate's.
"You either begin searching for those children, or release me so I can."
"We can't release you," Kuznati said.
"Why not?"
"We haven't ruled you out as a suspect."
"That's absurd."
"I know, Doctor, I know, trust me. But what would you have me do? I can't tell my investigators who is and is not a suspect. That would be improper. I have, however, convinced them to keep you in this holding cell. They insisted I move you to the common holding area. Those are co-ed, and I'm afraid not well monitored."
He paused a moment, then opened the file again.
"But I think I can at least delay that for a while. In the meantime, I have some questions of my own. Our records say you bought a condo here in Jakarta, paid cash, the equivalent of $700,000 US dollars. He looked up at her, and when she said nothing, he continued.
Our bank contact says you keep a checking account with an average balance of 300,000 U.S. equivalent dollars. That account receives periodic transfers from a bank in the Cayman Islands.
My bank balance has nothing to do with this.
I'm sure it doesn't. But you can see how it looks to my investigators. How did you get so much money, if I may ask?
I inherited it.
The chief raised his brows and seemed to brighten.
Ah, from your grandparents?
No, from my father.
Look, we're wasting time here.
What did he do?
Who?
Your father.
Banking, I think, or he was an investor. I don't know. I was very young.
I see.
The chief nodded.
I believe we can help each other, Doctor. We can convince my investigators that you are not involved in the kidnapping and give my department the resources it desperately needs to find these helpless children.
Kate stared at him. It all made sense now.
I'm listening.
I believe you, Dr. Warner. But as I say, my investigators, they look at the evidence and they know what a jury will think. And between me and you, Dr. Warner, I think maybe a little bit they dislike foreigners, maybe especially Americans. I believe the only way to really ensure your safety and to get what we both want is to find these children. That will clear your name.
So what are we waiting for?
As I said before, Dr. Warner, we are a small department. Finding these children, I would need more resources, people outside my department. But I am sorry to say, an investigation like this would cost a lot.
Probably $2 million?
Ah, U.S. dollars. But if I call in some favors, I think we could do it for $1.5 million.
But time is of the essence, my dear doctor. The children could be anywhere by now. I can only hope they are still alive.
$1.5 million. The chief nodded.
You'll have it, but you release me first.
I would like nothing more, Doctor, believe me. But promises made by suspects in interrogation rooms.
He lifted his hands.
Fine, get me a phone and the details of the bank account, and get me a car.
Right away, Doctor.
He smiled, stood, and left. He left Kate in the interrogation room alone. She sat at the table again, put a knee up in the chair, and ran her hand through her blonde hair. The woman in the mirrored wall looked nothing like the hopeful scientist who had moved to Jakarta 4 years ago. The chief shut the door to the interrogation room. 1.5 million. He could retire. His whole family could retire. 1.5 million. Could he have gotten more? Maybe 2 or 2.5? 3 million? She could have more, much more. She agreed to 1.5 instantly. Maybe he could go back and say he'd have to hire more people. It will cost 4 million. He would have taken 250,000, and he expected to get less. He stood in front of the interrogation room and pondered what to do. He wouldn't go back immediately. He would soften her up even more. A few hours in the drunk tank with the cameras off. He'd have to be careful. He didn't want her running to the U.S. Embassy afterward. But if he was careful, he would make some real money today. Chapter 16. Secure Comms Room, Clock Tower Station HQ, Jakarta, Indonesia. Josh glanced at the red dots on the positioning screen. In the hour since David had left, the 24 red dots, representing all of Jakarta Station's field operatives, had moved from Station HQ to locations across the city. Now the map showed 4 groups of 6 dots each. Josh knew 3 of the locations well. They were Jakarta Station's safe houses. The 18 agents at these locations must be on David's suspect list. The dots at the safe houses moved about slowly, turning back when they reached the walls that held them, like an accused man pacing a holding cell, waiting to hear his fate. The strategy was sound. David had divided the possible enemy forces and given himself time to see them coming, if they did attack. When they attacked. Seeing the dots on the map had given Josh a sense of dread.
had made the threat real. It was happening. The battle for Jakarta Station was only a matter of time. At some point, the dots would break free from the safe houses, descend on David's group of six soldiers, then come back to HQ to take care of Josh. David had simply bought them time. Time for Josh to sift the day's local intel and work on the code, to find something. And he wasn't sure if he had. He watched the SAT video again. It was all he had. What if he was wrong? He ran his hand through his hair. It was certainly outside the box. But if it was nothing? Intelligence work often came down to instinct. The van, the operation, it didn't feel right to Josh. He dialed David and said, "I think I have something."
"Go ahead," David said.
"A kidnapping. Two kids from a medical clinic reported to Jakarta PD several hours ago. Clock Tower flagged it as a low-priority local incident, but the van is a commercial vehicle registered to a Hong Kong-based dummy operation that is a known Imari front. And frankly, it doesn't look like locals. This was a professional kidnapping. Usually we'd file it under standard kidnapping and ransom, but Imari wouldn't bother with a K&R. I'm still digging, but I'm 99% sure this is an Imari operation, and a high-priority one given how overt it was, grabbing the kids during the day and with a van they knew we would trace. It means they couldn't wait."
"So, what does it mean?"
"I'm not sure yet. The strange thing is that it looks like another Imari company, Imari Research, funds the clinic. The money for the building and its monthly expenses is paid from a Jakarta-based holding corporation, Imari Jakarta. There are several references to it in your files. The company's history dates back almost 200 years. It was a subsidiary of the Dutch East India Company during the colonial era. It could be Imari's major operating center here in Southeast Asia."
"Doesn't make sense. Why would one Imari unit take kids from another? Maybe an internal feud? What do we know about the staff at the clinic?"
"Not much. There aren't many of them. A few lab techs, one of them killed during the incident. A rotating staff of nannies for the kids, mostly locals, not connected. And the lead scientist." He pulled up a file of Dr. Catherine Warner. "She arrived during the breach. Must have been incapacitated. No one left for over an hour. Local police have her now at a Jakarta substation."
"Have they put out any interagency alerts on the kids?"
"No."
"Public APBs?"
"Nope, but I have a theory. We have a source in the West Jakarta police. He filed a report 15 minutes ago. Says the police chief is extorting an American national, female. I assume it's Dr. Warner."
"Hmm. What does the clinic do?"
"It's a research facility, actually, genetic research. They're studying new therapies for autistic children. Basically anyone with a developmental disorder."
"Doesn't exactly scream international terrorism."
"Agree.
So, what's the working theory here? What are we looking at?"
"Honestly, I have no idea. I haven't gotten too deep into the weeds on this one, but one thing jumps out. The study hasn't filed any patents."
"Why is that significant? You think they're not doing research?"
"No, I'm pretty sure they are, just based on the equipment they've imported and the setup. But it's not for the money. If they wanted to commercialize what they're studying, they would patent it first. That's standard procedure for clinical trials. You find a compound in a lab, patent it, then test it. The patent prevents the competition from stealing a sample from a trial and patenting it first, cutting you off from the market. You would only test something without a patent if you didn't want the world to know about it. And Jakarta makes sense to do that. A U.S.-based trial with any patients would legally require an application to the FDA and disclosure of the trial therapy."
"So they're developing a bioweapon?"
"Maybe. But before today, the clinic hasn't had any incidents. They've registered no fatalities, so if they are testing it on the kids, it would make it the least effective bioweapon of all time. Based on what I see, the research is legit and well-intentioned. In fact, if they did achieve their research goal, it would be a huge medical breakthrough."
"Which would also make it a great cover. But one question, why steal from yourself?"
If Amari funds the clinic and runs the clinic, why would they need to use their own people to steal the kids?
Maybe the researcher got cold feet about the weapon? About what they're doing? David said.
Could be.
Does the source at Jakarta PD have the authority to release the doctor?
No, apparently he's a little lower on the totem pole.
Do we have a file on the chief?
Stand by.
Josh searched Clock Tower's database, and when the chief's file appeared, he leaned back in his chair.
Yeah, we've got a file.
Wow.
Send it to my mobile command center.
Have you gone through all of the local intel yet?
Yeah, this was the only thing that really jumped out, but there is something else.
Josh had debated whether to mention it, but like the video of the kidnapping, it didn't feel right.
None of the other cells have reported being attacked, and Central hasn't released any advisories. There's been nothing in the news either, nothing since the fighting in Karachi, Cape Town, and Mar del Plata. All the cells are quiet, releasing routine reports as if nothing is going on.
Speculation? David said.
Two possibilities. Either they're waiting for something, maybe our next move, or
the rest of the cells fell without a fight.
Yeah.
We may be the last major cell, Josh said.
I want you to work on the code as quickly as you can.
Chapter 17. Imari Corp Research Complex, outside Barang, China. Tibet Autonomous Region. Dr. Shen Cheng tried to suppress his nervousness as the video conference connected. When the man appeared, Cheng swallowed hard and said,
"The project director ordered me to contact you, Dr. Gray. We followed the protocol and research provided to the letter. I simply don't know what..."
"I'm sure you did, Dr. Cheng, but the result was very surprising. Why did the children survive and not the adults?"
"We've entertained a few possibilities, and we've run tests on the children. We believe they do show sustained Atlantis gene activation, and clearly they survived the machine, which is proof in and of itself that they're immune."
"Is it possible the therapy won't work on adults?"
"Yes, perhaps. The therapy is a retrovirus that inserts a gene into the subject's genetic code. It's not a significant genetic change, but it does have a cascade effect at the epigenetic level, turning on and off a series of other pre-existing genes in the host. There are no physiological effects, not that we've been able to observe, but there is a massive change in the brain. The gene essentially rewires the subject's brain. Neuroplasticity, the ability for the brain to rewire or adapt, decreases with age. That's why it's harder to learn new things as we grow older. We've explored the idea that adults won't respond to the therapy because the gene activation can't trigger the changes in the brain. Essentially, the genetic therapy virus tries to rewire the brain, but the circuit boards are already hardwired, have been since shortly after childhood.
Is it possible that the adult subjects didn't have the precursor genes to affect the brain changes?
No, all the adult subjects had the cascade genes. As you know, we have known about these genes for some time, and we test every subject on site at our hiring facility here in China to verify. The adults should have survived the test.
Is it possible the therapy only works on autistic brains?
Cheng hadn't considered this possibility. Dr. Gray was an evolutionary biologist with an interest in paleobiology, and he was Cheng's boss's boss, all the way at the top of the Imari food chain. Cheng had assumed this call wouldn't focus on the science. He had expected a tongue-lashing from this uber-boss for his failed efforts. He focused on Gray's hypothesis. Yes, it certainly could be. Autism is fundamentally a disorder of brain wiring, especially in the areas that control communication and social understanding, and other areas are affected. Some affected individuals are highly intelligent with special abilities. Others are on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. They can't even live independently. Autism is really a catch-all category for a variety of differences in brain wiring. We would have to look into this, and it could take some time. We would likely need more test subjects.
Time we don't have, but we might be able to get more children. Although these are the only subjects we know of with Atlantis gene activation. Let me look into that. What else?
Is there anything you haven't told me? Any other theories?
There are no bad ideas at this point, Dr. Chang.
Chang did have another idea, something he hadn't voiced to the rest of the team. I've personally wondered whether the adults and the children were treated with the same therapy.
A problem with replicating Dr. Warner's research?
With formulation?
No, as I say, we followed her protocol to the letter. I stand by that. I'm wondering if Dr. Warner treated these children with something different. Something not in her official notes or the trial protocol.
Gray seemed to consider Cheng's idea.
That's very interesting.
I wonder if I could speak with Dr. Warner. A meeting would be very helpful at this point.
I'm not sure. Let me get back to you on that.
Have any of the other team members voiced this concern?
No, not that I know of.
I'd like for you to keep your suspicions about Dr. Warner to yourself. From now on, contact me directly. I'll inform the project director that you and I are working together now and that he will support your efforts, without asking questions. See that the rest of the team keeps the findings within the group. It's very important that we keep a tight lid on this for the time being.
I understand, Dr. Chang said, but he really didn't. The call had raised more questions, and he was now convinced of one thing. They had used the wrong therapy.
Chapter 18. West Jakarta Police Detention Center, Jakarta, Indonesia. Chief Kusnadi was about to reach for the interrogation room door when a man blocked his path. He was an American, or maybe European, definitely a soldier of some sort. He had the build and the eyes.
"Who are you?"
Kusnadi asked the man.
"That's not important. I'm here to pick up Dr. Catherine Warner."
"The hell you are! Tell me who you are before I throw you in a cell."
The man handed him a manila envelope and said, "Take a look. It's nothing you haven't seen before." The police chief opened the envelope and looked at the first few pictures. He couldn't believe his eyes.
How? How could they have?
"If you don't release her right now, you won't be the last to see those." Kusnadi shoved the pictures back into the envelope.
"I want the originals."
"Does this sound like a negotiation to you?"
"Release her, or my organization will release the contents of that envelope." Kusnadi's eyes looked down, then darted side to side, like a cornered animal deciding which way to run.
"And just in case you're considering throwing me in a cell, if my people don't get my call within 3 minutes, they'll release this file anyway. You work for me now. You want to be chief of police or not?"
Kusnadi had to think. He looked around at the department.
Who could do this?
"Time's up." The man turned to leave.
"Wait!"
The police chief opened the door to the interrogation room and motioned for the woman to come out.
"This man will escort you out."
The woman paused at the door and looked at Kusnadi before looking the soldier up and down.
"It's okay, this man will take you now."
The man put his arm around her back and said, "Follow me, Dr. Warner. We're getting out of here." Kusnadi watched them walk out of the station. Outside the police station, Kate stopped and turned to the man who had rescued her. He was dressed in black body armor, eerily similar to the man who had taken her children. And so were his men. She saw them now, 5 of them, standing in front of a large black truck, like an oversized UPS delivery truck, and a black SUV with tinted windows.
"Who are you? I want to know."
"Hang on just a second," he said. The man walked over to the short interrogator who had accused Kate of buying the children. The soldier handed the little man a folder and said,
"I hear you're in line for a promotion."
The little man shrugged.
"I just do what I'm told," he said, sheepishly.
"Your case officer says you're a good source. If you're smart enough to know what to do with this, maybe you'll be a better police chief." The interrogator nodded.
"Anything you want, boss."
The soldier walked back to Kate and motioned toward the large black delivery truck.
"I need you to get in the truck."
"I'm not going anywhere until you tell me who you are and what's going on."
"I'll explain, but right now, we have to get you to a safe location."
"No, you—" "Here's a tip.
The good guys ask you to get in the truck.
The bad guys put a black bag over your head and throw you in the truck. I'm asking. Look, you can stay here or go with me. It's up to you. He walked toward the truck and opened the double doors at the rear. Hold on. I'm coming. Chapter 19. Clock Tower Station HQ, Jakarta, Indonesia. Vincent Teria, the head of field operations for Clock Tower Jakarta, massaged his arm muscles as the station's staff filed into the primary conference room. His arms and legs still ached from the attack from those two fools at the clinic and those feral children, and the day had gotten worse from there. But he could put it back on track. He only needed to convince a few of the Jakarta staff to go along with the attack. The rest were already on the Amari payroll. Teria held his hands up to quiet the crowd. Everyone at Clock Tower HQ was there. All the analysts, all the case officers, and all the field operatives. Everyone except David Vale and the five operatives with him. Josh Cohen, the head of analysis, was also missing, but they would find him soon enough. The large screens on the conference room wall showed three crowded rooms, full of field operatives, confined to safe houses across the city.
Okay, listen up, everyone. Can you all hear me on the video links? Heads nodded, followed by a series of, yeah, and we've got you. There's no easy way to say this, so I'll just say it. Clock Tower has been compromised.
You could hear a pin drop in the room.
And we're under attack. I received reports earlier today that several cells, including Cape Town, Mar del Plata, and Karachi, have been completely destroyed. Several other stations are fighting for their lives as we speak.
People began talking in low tones. Some shouted questions.
Hold on, everybody. It gets worse. I'm afraid the enemy we're fighting is one of our own. Here's what we know at this point. Several days ago, David Vale, along with several other station chiefs, organized a meeting of all the chief analysts. Obviously, this is strictly against protocol. We believe they told the analysts there was some new threat. We now know that over half the analysts never returned from the conference. The entire charade was a mass execution, we believe, to cripple our intelligence analysis before this larger attack. The analysts who returned to their cells are now actively working against Clock Tower.
Teria surveyed the doubtful looks around the room.
Look, I know this is hard to believe, and like you, I don't want to believe it. In fact, I didn't believe it, not until this morning, when David spread our field operatives out throughout the city. Think about it. He's spreading us out so we can't defend against an attack. He's preparing to take down Jakarta Station. It's only a matter of time.
Why? Someone said. He wouldn't do that, another person added.
I asked the same question. I said the same thing,
Teria said.
He recruited me. I served with him. I know him. But there's a lot about David Vale we still don't understand. We all come to Clock Tower for our own reasons. From what we can gather, David was seriously injured during the attacks on 9/11. I didn't know that until today. Since then, he's harbored a conspiracy theory about 9/11, some wild ideas about military contractors instigating the attack for their own gain. He may even be the victim of a lie himself. Someone could be using him. Either way, he's sick, turned around, and he's brought a lot of other people into the conspiracy. We think Josh Cohen has returned from the analyst conference and is working with the chief.
Everyone was silent, seeming to take the news in. A soldier at one of the safe houses on the video screen said, "What's the operation? Bring him in?"
"That may not be possible. He'll fight to the end. The priority is to minimize the collateral damage. And we're going to have some help. Amari Security has offered to lend us some men. They're aware of the situation, and they want to see this contained as much as we do. It seems Amari is the target of David's vendetta. We know that David has captured a scientist who works on an Amari-funded project. She could be a co-conspirator, or just a victim in his plans. We're not sure yet. The plan is to recover the woman, Dr. Catherine Warner, and neutralize the chief.
Chapter 20. Secure Comms Room, Clock Tower Station HQ,
Jakarta, Indonesia. Josh waited nervously to find out whether his theory about the coded message David had given him was correct. It was Josh's best idea, really his only idea. He tried not to stare at the main computer screen on the long wall of the glass room. For the last 30 minutes, the screen had said the same thing. Searching. He glanced at the two screens beside it, a video feed of the door outside, and the city map with 24 red dots representing Clock Tower Jakarta's field operatives. He didn't know which display made him more nervous. They might as well be giant countdown screens, ticking away the seconds to his death, and some terrible unknown catastrophe, while the other screen still simply said, "Searching." Should the search have taken this long? What if he was wasting time? Something else made him nervous. He glanced at the field box David had left on the table. He stood and grabbed the box, but as he lifted it, the bottom fell open. The gun and cyanide capsules tumbled onto the table, the clanging noise shattering the silence. The sound seemed to echo for hours that felt like a dream. Finally, Josh reached for the gun and two pills. His hands were shaking. On the wall, a beep snapped him out of the moment. The larger screen read, 5 results. 5 results? Josh sat down at the table and worked the wireless keyboard and mouse. 3 results from the New York Times, 1 from the Daily Mail in London, and 1 from the Boston Globe. Maybe he was right. From the moment he had seen the names and dates, his first thought was, they're obituaries. Obituaries and classifieds were classic spycraft. Operatives after World War II routinely used them to send messages across spy networks spread across the globe. It was old school, but if the message had been passed in 1947, it could have been a viable method. If it was true, this terrorist network was over 65 years old. He pushed the implications of that to the back of his mind. He looked at the coded message David had given him. Toba Protocol is real. 4 plus 12 plus 47 equals 4 over 5. Jones. 7 plus 22 plus 47 equals 3 over 8. Anderson. 10 plus 4 plus 47 equals 5 over 4. Ames. Then he turned to the results. It was more likely the terrorists had used one paper. One paper that was available in cities around the world. The New York Times was the most likely candidate. Even in 1947, you could walk up to a newsstand in Paris, London, Shanghai, Barcelona, or Boston and get the day's copy of the New York Times, paid obituaries included. If the obituaries were coded messages, they should have been flagged in some way. Josh saw it immediately. Each of the Times obituaries had the words clock and tower. He leaned back in his chair. Was it possible that Clock Tower was that old? The CIA wasn't formally established until the National Security Act of 1947, although its precursor organization, the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, was created during World War II, in June of 1942. Why would the terrorists mention Clock Tower? Maybe they were fighting Clock Tower back then, in 1947, 66 years ago? He needed to focus on the obituaries. There must be a way to decode them. The ideal encryption system would feature a variable cipher. There would be no one key that could decrypt a message. Each message would include its own key, something simple. He opened the first obituary, dated 4/12/1947. Adam Jones, pioneering clockmaker, dies at 77 working on his tower masterpiece. Adam Jones, leading Gibraltar clockmaker, died Saturday in British Honduras. He was found by his valet. His bones will be interred near his late wife's, a site they selected together. Please send a card or advise family if visiting. The message was here somewhere. What was the key? Josh opened the other obituaries and scanned them, hoping for some sort of clue. Each obituary contained a location, and each one was early in the text. Josh ran through several possibilities, rearranged several words, then sat back and thought. The obituaries were written awkwardly, like certain words were out of order, or forced, like they had to use those words. The order, the intervals. He saw it. The names were the cipher. The lengths of the names. It was the second part of the code. 4 plus 12 plus 47 equals 4 over 5, Jones. The 4-12-1947 obituary was for Adam Jones. 4 over 5. The first name was 4 letters, the last name was 5. If he took the fourth word of the obituary, then counted 5 words after that, and repeated, it yielded a sentence. He re-examined the obituary. Adam Jones, pioneering clockmaker, dies at 77, working on his tower masterpiece. Adam Jones, leading Gibraltar clockmaker, died Saturday in British Honduras. He was found by his valet. His bones will be interred near his late wife's, a site they selected together. Please send a card or advise family if visiting. Together the message read, Gibraltar, British found bones near site. Please advise. Josh studied the message for a moment. He didn't see that coming, and he had no idea what it meant. He searched the internet and came up with a few results. Apparently the British had found bones in Gibraltar in the 1940s, in a natural sea cave called Gorham's Cave. But they weren't human bones. They were Neanderthal bones, and they had radically changed what the world knew about Neanderthals. Our prehistoric cousins were actually much more than archaic cavemen. They built homes, and they built huge fires on stone hearths, cooked vegetables, spoke a language, created cave art, buried their dead with flowers, and made advanced stone tools and pottery. The bones at Gibraltar also changed the Neanderthal timeline. Before the Gibraltar find, Neanderthals were thought to have died out around 40,000 years ago. The Neanderthals at Gibraltar had lived roughly 23,000 years ago, far later than previously thought. Gibraltar was likely the Neanderthals' last stand. What could an ancient Neanderthal fortress have to do with a global terrorist attack? Maybe the other messages would shed some light. Josh opened the second obituary and decoded it. Antarctica. U-boat not found. Advise if further search authorized. Interesting. Josh ran a few searches. 1947 had been a busy year in Antarctica. On December 12, 1946, the U.S. Navy sent a huge armada, including 13 ships, with almost 5,000 men, to Antarctica. The mission, codenamed Operation High Jump, was to establish the Antarctic Research Base, Little America 4. There had long been conspiracy theories and speculation that the U.S. was looking for secret Nazi bases and technology in Antarctica. Did the message mean they hadn't found it? Josh turned the thick, glossy page with the message over and examined the photo. A massive chunk of ice floated in a blue sea, and at its center, a black sub stuck out of the ice. The writing on the sub was too small to read, but it had to be the Nazi sub. Based on the likely size of the sub, the iceberg was maybe 10 square miles, big enough to be found from Antarctica. Did this mean they had found the sub recently? Had the discovery set events in motion? Josh turned to the last message, hoping it would provide a clue. Decoded it. It read, Roswell, weather balloon matches Gibraltar technology. We must meet. Together, all three messages were, Gibraltar, British found bones near site, please advise. Antarctica, U-boat not found. Advise if further search authorized. Roswell, weather balloon matches Gibraltar technology. We must meet. What did it mean? A site in Gibraltar,
a U-boat in Antarctica, and the last one, a weather balloon in Roswell that matched technology in Gibraltar? There was a larger question. Why? Why reveal these messages? They were 65 years old. How could it be connected to what's happening now? To the battle for Clock Tower and an imminent terrorist attack? Josh paced. He had to think. If I were a mole inside a terrorist organization trying to call for help, what would I do? Trying to call for help. The source would have left a way to contact him. Another code? No, maybe he was revealing the method, how to contact him. The obituaries. But that would be inefficient. Newspaper obituaries would take at least a day to appear, even online. Online. What would be the modern equivalent? Where would you post? Josh ran through several ideas. The newspaper obituaries had been easy. There were only a few papers to check. Aggregating all the past obituaries had taken some time, but he had one key advantage. He knew where to look. The message could be anywhere online. There had to be another clue. What did the three messages have in common? A location. What was different about them? There were no people in Antarctica, no classifieds, no... What? What was different about Roswell and Gibraltar? Both had newspapers. What could you do in one and not the other? To post something. The source was pointing him to a posting system as ubiquitous today as the New York Times was in 1947. Craigslist. It had to be. Josh checked. No Craigslist in Gibraltar, but yes, there was a Craigslist board for Roswell, Carlsbad, New Mexico. Josh opened it and began reading through the messages. There were thousands of them, in dozens of categories, for sale, housing, community, jobs, resumes. There would be hundreds of new postings each day. How could he find the source's message, if it was even there? He could use a web aggregation technology to gather the site's content. A clock tower server would crawl the site, similar to the way Google and Bing indexed websites, extracting content and making it searchable. Then he could run the cipher program, see if any of the postings translated. It would only take a few hours. He didn't have a few hours. He needed a place to start. Obituaries was the logical choice, but Craigslist didn't have obituaries. What would be the closest category? Maybe personals? He scanned the headings. Strictly platonic, women seeking women seeking men seeking women seeking men, miscellaneous romance, casual encounters, missed connections, rants and raves. Where to start? Was he on a wild goose chase? He didn't have time to waste. Maybe a few more minutes. One more group of messages. Missed connections was an interesting category. The idea was that if you saw someone you were interested in, but didn't get a chance to make a connection, ask them out, you posted here. It was popular with guys who, in the moment, couldn't find the courage to ask a cute waitress out. Josh had actually posted to it several times. If the person saw the message and replied, then there you were. No pressure. If not, it wasn't meant to be. He opened it and read a few entries. Subject: green dress at CVS. Message: my God, you were stunning. You're perfect, and I was totally speechless. Would love to talk to you. Email me. Subject: Hampton Hotel. Message: we were getting water together at the desk and then got on the elevator together. Didn't know if you wanted to get together for a little extra exercise. Tell what floor I got off on. I saw your wedding ring. We can be discreet, too. He read a few more. The message would be longer if it followed the same pattern, a message within a message, decoded by the name length as a cipher. Craigslist was anonymous. The name would be the email address. On the next page, the first entry was, subject: saw you in the old Tower Records building talking about the new Clock Opera single. Promising. Clock and tower in the subject line.
Josh clicked the posting and read it quickly. It was much longer than the others. The email address was andy@gmail.com. Josh scribbled down every fourth word, then every fifth word from the posting. The decoded posting produced, "Situation changed. Clock tower will fall. Reply if still alive. Trust no one." Josh froze. Reply if still alive? He had to reply. David had to reply. Josh picked up the sat phone and dialed David, but it wouldn't connect. He had called him earlier. It wasn't the room or the phone. What could... He saw it. The video feed from the door outside. It wasn't changing. He watched closely. The lights on the servers were staying on, but it never happened that way. They always blinked occasionally as the hard drives were accessed, as network cards sent and received packets. It wasn't a video feed. It was a picture. A picture put there by whoever was trying to get into the room. Chapter 21. Main Situation Room, Clock Tower Station HQ, Jakarta, Indonesia. The Situation Room was busy. Operations technicians typed at various keyboards, analysts filtered in and out with reports, and Vincent Turia paced back and forth watching the wall of screens. "Are we sure Vale is getting a false location map?" "Yes, sir," one of the techs said. "Tell the safe houses to move out." Turia watched the safe house video feeds as the soldiers marched to the doors and pulled them open. The sound of the explosions turned every head in the large situation room to the monitors, which now showed fuzzy black and white static. One of the techs punched a keyboard. "Switching to outside video. Sir, we have a massive detonation at..." "I know! Safe houses, hold your positions!" Turia yelled. No sound came over the speakers. The location map was completely black where the red dots had paced around the safe houses. The only dots left were David's convoy and the small group left at HQ. The tech swiveled around. "He must have rigged the safe houses to blow." Turia rubbed the bridge of his nose. "Thank you, Captain Obvious. Are we in that quiet room yet? Did they find Josh?" "No, they're about to start." Turia walked out of the situation room into his private office and picked up the phone. He dialed his counterpart at Amari Security. "We have a problem. He took out my men here." He listened a moment. "No, look, I convinced them, but he..." "It doesn't matter. They're all dead. That's the bottom line." Another pause. "No, well, if I were you, I would make damn sure you kill him with the first strike. No matter how many men you've got, he'll be incredibly hard to contain in the field." He started to set the phone down, but jerked it back impatiently at the last minute. "What?" "No, we're looking. We think he's here. I'll keep you posted." "What?" "Fine, I'll come, but I only have two men I can bring, and we're staying in the rear in case it goes south." Chapter 22. Clock Tower Mobile Operations Center, Jakarta, Indonesia. Kate followed the soldier into the large black truck. Inside, it looked nothing like the delivery truck it had appeared to be. It was part locker room, with weapons and gear she didn't recognize, part office with screens and computers, and part bus with rows of sunken seats along each side. There were three large screens. One showed dots on a map she assumed was Jakarta. The other showed a video feed of the front, rear, and both sides of the truck. On the top right picture, the black SUV could be seen leading the truck through Jakarta's crowded streets. The final screen was blank, except for one word. Connecting.
"I'm David Vale."
"I want to know where you're taking me," Kate demanded.
"A safe house."
David was fiddling with a tablet computer of some sort. It seemed to manipulate one of the screens on the wall. He glanced up at it, as if waiting for something to appear. When it didn't, he hit a few more buttons.
"So you're with the American government?" Kate said, trying to get his attention. Not exactly. He looked down, still working the tablet. But you are an American.
Sort of.